California and to Michigan you have come. To the richness of the valley, to toil in the sun. With your wife and seven children, they're working, everyone. And what will you be giving to your brown-eyed children of the sun? Cuando caliente el sol, cuando caliente el sol.
Studs Terkel called the late Chuy Negrete the Chicano Woody Guthrie because of his songs about centuries of the Mexican Latino experience. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. We use terms like Latino, Hispanic, Chicano, Mexican American. How much diversity is there within what we might think of as one Spanish-speaking minority group? Why do protest groups organize days without immigrants and Mexicans? To show America how much their economy depends on exploited workers too often in the shadows? What are some of the possibilities for a better future? My guest is Armando Ibarra, professor of labor and working class studies in the School for Workers in UW's Division of Continuing Studies, and the co-author of The Latino Question, Politics, Laboring Classes, and the Next Left. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was going to ask you to start with your own story, which you make part of your work, your own story of being a migrant worker in this country. Can you kind of tell us about your family and your own journey from that experience to the work you now do for your career?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I want to bring to the forefront before I begin on my story is to talk about positionality and positionality to research, which is often debated in the social sciences. That's where I'm situated right now. And the idea that positionality to research can bias, research outcomes. And, you know, when you're a person of my background that studies what I study and this, and my positionality to the research is very, very much on level, right? So the people that I work alongside to produce scholarship share a very similar background to me. That is of an immigrant laborer whose story doesn't begin or end with just me and my family in terms of that. The immigration is not a unit of one or an end of one. This is something that's connected generationally. And so, for example, in the case of my family, there's been people that have been immigrating to the U.S. since the early 1900s. So over a century of migration is part of me, right, which is an immigrant today. So this is a continual process that has taken at least a century in my particular story. And so it's nothing new. It's actually something that's very much a real part of not just the Mexican story, but of the development of the United States. So as much as migration seems new, it's been a part of the base of our social structure here in our country today. So having said that about positionality mm-hmm. and about my research and a little bit about the immigration experience or the mass labor migration experience within my family, this really speaks to our scholarship overall. But let me tell you a little bit about myself. So I was brought to the United States at a very young age. And by a young age, I think it was 16 or 18 months of age, right? I had no choice. I was part already of this process of labor migration that had been going on in my particular case, in my family, well before even my mother and father were born. So when we start thinking about it in those terms is that migration is part of the lived social structure of generations for at least our family, which is something that's not unique. And it shows in the number of Mexicans or Mexican origin people in the U.S. I think I read something about 10.5 million Mexicans now or Mexican Americans reside in the U.S., which is a substantial number. So I was brought at 18 months, and we came in step migration. And my source of information is my mother. My mother is a repository of information for our family, and she makes it as part of her daily activities to tell us the stories of us. And not just to me, but to everybody in the family, including second, third, and now even fourth generation of family members here in the U.S. So we can sit around and talk with mom, and she'll tell us our story, the story of us. And the story of us is not a U.S. story or a Mexican story. It's much bigger than that. And I have to explicitly state that.
So when you say much bigger than that, mm-hmm. You mean because of the labor needs and the sort of seasonal work, or bigger in terms of just the whole immigration story of this country?
So the development of our story is a human story. It's not a story of that was created by labor needs. It was not a story that's bound in immigration. It's a story of human development. And that's the way I like to frame it. So it's all these things combined, right? That social, political, that cultural political economy that we like to talk about is where we're at in the current state. So we can come back to that in a little bit. But it's a story that when we talk about the immigrant story, it's something that is retold almost every year, you know, the same story here in our country. And I want to refocus again on my story for a little bit. So when I was brought over, me and my sister were brought, first dad came, worked for many years, worked in different states of the country, saved enough money to be able to bring mom. Mom came over, brought me, the youngest at the time, and my oldest sister, and had to leave siblings behind. So this hard choice of leaving your children behind because of the extreme poverty that you're living in.
That's the most heartrending when I see current stories of, you know, the thousands of miles sometimes that a family will travel, and then the heartrending separation from parts of the family, I think, are so hard to imagine.
Yes. And to this day, in our particular case, there is still a lot of hurt because of that separation that's often framed as a choice. But there is very little choice that is made when you're faced with extreme poverty and not being able to give to your children the basics, food, shelter, medicine. And that is what drives or what drove my particular family to begin to immigrate. So we have this separation. We have this broken family structure. And this is the case for millions of other families that are coming at that time from Mexico, but also today from all of Latin America, as we see that. So at that particular point, my dad was in Southern California, mom and my oldest sister, myself, end up in Southern California. And this, again, I'm telling you through the eyes of my mother and through her memories. Mm-hmm. If I get choked up a little bit, I feel like I feel her memories in me, like they're recreated in me, if I was the adult at the time. That's kudos to my mom. I am my father. But they lived in Southern California. My father worked as a construction worker and as a, somebody who used to work in the lawn care industry as well, mowing lawns, right? My mother worked in a sweatshop. She was a seamstress. She used to sew. And the story is that she worked day and night for 18 months, for almost 2 years, sewing at during the job and then bringing additional clothing home to put together in the home to be able to save enough money to go and unify our family.
And how do they know, your parents, how do they know where to go in Southern California and what to do?
Yeah. So these are, there was already a population from my parents' hometown in Mexico, living in the area in Southern California, as there was in Denver, Colorado, where that's where my father worked as well, as there was in Chicago, and there is. And so there's already established co-ethnic, co-racial communities with large numbers of people from the region where they're from in Jalisco. So those are those social networks that they were able to tap into to at least know that when they arrive to this place, they'll know somebody there already. With regards to jobs, you know, it's where their friends are already working or were working and were able to get employed in that manner. It's very similar to what we see today in terms of migration patterns and also settlement here in Wisconsin. People come here to work and stay here. And the poor people that come from the same region will attract other folks, family member, friends, and that continues that as Massey et al. Would say, it's that cumulative causation of migration, those social relations that condition immigration in folks in that journey. So we moved there and worked right up for my parents. This is after my mom and dad had been able to go back and bring my other siblings. So now we're all reunited, right? We're all living in Southern California, in an apartment with other families, right? And other folks that are here, other single men, that are whose survival strategies is to pool their money so that they can be able to pay their rent. Mm-hmm. So the story is that we shared a closet space and that we also got the tub. So that's where we slept. And so when we were all here, it was just too many people and the work dried out for my father. So basically leaving us without any income to be able to survive in Southern California. So for a period, we were homeless. You know, we were a family that was displaced from their home country and also homeless here now. So word got to one of my family members that this was our situation, and he got in contact with my mother, it was his uncle, and told us to come down to Northern California and that there was plenty of work there. So we get into the station wagon and we're driven up to Northern California, where we ended up settling in a farm worker labor camp. And that's where my story begins. As a part of this migrant farm worker family, right?
What kind of farm work were you doing and at what age?
Yeah. Well, I was introduced to farm work very early on, maybe 4 years old. I was introduced as a worker by the time I was five. I was working alongside my mother's siblings, picking prunes from the ground. So basically what happens is when they harvest prunes, is that there's a shaker that goes and it shakes all the fruit off the tree, right? And then there's another machine that catches all the fruit. And so, but some of that fruit falls off the machine or stays on the tree. And so the machines go through. Then what you have that comes behind the machines is people that pick whatever the machines drop on the ground. So it's really extremely difficult work to be on your knees, in the middle of summer in Northern California, which is, you know, quite often over 100 degrees, picking fruit from the ground into 5-gallon buckets. And then from those 5-gallon buckets, dumping them into these bins that take 45-gallon buckets of prunes. And that was my introduction into farm work. So imagine your fingers are, they're baked from the dry heat, and your body is beaten up by the labor that you're doing, and you're 5 years old. That was my introduction to farm work. I also picked peaches. I also picked plums. I've picked walnuts, kiwi fruit, and worked pruning, preparing crops, maintaining trees, all to so that they could be harvested by the property owner.
One of the stories that I assigned in my Odyssey classes is called The Circuit by Francisco Jimenez, and it's about his experiences working the fields as a child and not being able to go to school until later in the year, and then hearing English for the first time after speaking Spanish in the fields. Do you remember feeling like an outsider compared to some of the others who were not migrant workers? I mean, when did you become aware of kind of your position in this country? And how did you navigate education?
Oh, that's a real complex question. It might sound simple, but it goes to the core of most of us that come from these types of situations. Is I can tell you that in my experience, I knew I was an outsider when I was 4 or 5 years old. Okay, I knew that at any moment, we were taught not just by our families, but by our condition and by our placement in these farm worker labor camps, that you weren't like the rest. The farm worker labor camp was located at the banks of a river about 5 miles out of town. So that in itself places you in a geographical space that's separate. We were from where the farm worker kids live, right? The other thing is that most of us understood what it meant to be an immigrant who had a questionable immigration status. So we knew that any interaction with a public servant, whether it be an officer, whether it be a school teacher, or whether it be, La Migra, could result in deportation and in family separation. So our guards were always up. And I'm talking about a 5-6-year-old kid. So you know when you come from these contexts that you're an outsider. One of the things that I often talk about is that I did a study of folks that live in migrant farm worker labor, state-sponsored migrant and seasonal farm worker housing. And one of the things that always comes up is people know their position within society. It's quite ironic that oftentimes when we offer research on working people, in this particular case, on working people that happen to be unauthorized Latinx immigrants, that we assume that they don't know what their position is and what their vulnerabilities are for the place that they occupy in this country. It's ironic, right? It's like telling somebody that they're poor but trying to explain to a poor people what poverty is. It always it baffles my mind to think about when I do this type of research and I read the literature that this is a discovery. So we know we knew very early on what our position was. And as outsiders, I can give you a couple of examples of being an outsider. And there was those inter-ethnic outsiders, too. There was the kids and the adults that were, you know, that were the Mexican-American second generation and beyond that would treat us differently, too, you know, that would call us mojados, you know, that would call us mojados. Basically means wetback in Spanish. That's what it is. And that they would treat us as different folks. We're talking about people that originate from the exact same places in Mexico that when you're within a U.S. context, begin to treat you as an outsider because that's what is taught in this country. Racism is very real. And it very much conditions the way all folks think, including within this particular experience that we had. I was spanked as a kindergartner in the hometown where I was then for speaking Spanish. Mm. So the principal would line us all up and spank us during recess for speaking Spanish. But to us, it wasn't an act of rebellion. It wasn't an act of disobedience to the, you know, to the status quo or whatever they thought. It was who we were. That's how we communicated. You know, that's what our books were written in. Every Sunday when we went to Mass, that's what the preacher spoke in. That's what our parents, you know, that's what the songs that we listened to. So that to us was the most normal thing to do. But being spanked for the act of expressing yourself in that language, it's quite a hurtful way to try to make children feel welcomed.
We are going to talk about the whole Latino question of what happens to migrant families when they try to gain economic and social and political rights in this country. What do we need to know that we might not know about this story when we continue a moment with the University of the Year? My father used to say, it doesn't matter whether you work in the fields like I do or if you're president of this country, we're both human beings and we should be respected for who we are. Even though I was hurt when people called me you wetback or you chili stomper, I would listen to my father. What sustained my being able to break through was my family's love and their insistence on hard work, respect, faith, and the hope that no matter how difficult life was, if we worked very hard and applied ourselves, we would break through. Those are the words of Francisco Jimenez, who went on to become a distinguished Chicano studies professor and author. I'm Emily Auerbach. I'm back with my guest, Armando Ibarra, author of The Latino Question, Politics, Labor, and Classes, and the Next Left. Armando, you were talking about your incredible family story of coming over from Mexico and working so hard, even as a child, picking prunes and so on. I wonder, you know, if you think back to that five-year-old child, and now you're a professor, you won awards, you've got publications, you've got, you know, work that you're doing kind of about the area that you came out of. Would you have imagined that possible back then? And how did that journey, what was the key kind of turning point that made it possible for you?
I still can't imagine that it's possible. You know, and as they say, the exception to the rule is not the rule. I can't point to any particular event that conditioned my path or conditioned my journey to Wisconsin. You know, in solidarity circles, they say we make the path by walking. And I think that is part of what my path has been, is I've walked alongside many folks like me, and I've walked alongside people who see the inequities and are trying to fix them. And I walk on a path that was conditioned by those folks before me as well. I can say without a doubt that previous social movements and the outcomes of those social movements, the social policy, opened the door to folks in my situation. For example, I was a participant in a program called the Upward Bound Program, which is simply a program for high school low-income students in poverty to gain an understanding and access to higher to institutions of higher learning. So that was my first entree point into this idea that there's an alternative that I could pursue if I didn't want to continue where I was. And I have to say that where I was is a place of dignity. My parents to this day continue to be farm workers. They're in their 80s. My father's about to be 80. My mom is 77. They continue to work in the field. And I respect their hard work. I respect their dedication, their resilience. And, you know, I still to this day will say that farm work is dignified. What's not dignified is the exploitative conditions that exchange of labor for wages happens, right? So Upward Bound introduced me into higher ed. Equal Opportunity Program, EOP, accepted me or gave the entree into the institution of higher learning, and they tracked me. So we have those social programs there. And then once there, it was faculty. Faculty who had expertise in this whole field that I never knew existed.
The field of labor?
The field of labor and Chicano studies, right? Mm-hmm. And social movements later on that kind of just inspired me to learn. And learning, in the end, I came to understand is just work. If we start from the position that all humans, that we all have the similar intellect, that we all have the capacity to learn, that we all have the capacity to produce scholarship or whatever it is, right? Then that work ethic and the work that I did as a child, my last day in the fields was actually picking kiwi fruit in October, my junior year of college. So if mm-hmm. you're able to translate how you work, that discipline, right, of work into studying, into reading, into producing, then it only takes time before you're able to really reach parity with those folks that have been taught how to study before you got there.
Yeah, I guess it's just a different kind of work. When you were going through the work that you did and going through college and so on, how aware were you of sort of the history of, something like Cesar Chavez and the grape boycott and the, you know, attempts to get more rights for migrant workers and so on? And that history sometimes mm-hmm. seems to me not taught in the schools very adequately, so that we sort of have the situation sure. without knowing the history or the leaders or anything about it.
What I learned about the farm worker labor movement in California, I learned in the fields. Let me start from there. I worked with people that were on both sides of that struggle. And by that, I mean I worked with card-carrying UFW members. They were our veteranos, our veterans, right? They were the older folks that worked there that marched alongside the UFW.
UFW is?
The United Farm Workers of America, yeah. Which is the union that was organized by, that was led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and others, right? There is no union without workers, and so that's who they led was farm workers. And so I also, you know, worked alongside of folks who when they were being organized, were newcomers at the time and couldn't leave, you know, couldn't boycott, couldn't walk off the job because they were in working for a day or two. This is their stories, and needed and had children to feed at home. So it's a difficult story to tell. But I learned about the movement in the fields. I learned very little about the farm workers, the struggle for worker rights. You know, in my K-12, if nothing else, I probably got in trouble for knowing a little too much. again, my attachment to history is my mother, who would, you know, talk to us and teach us at home about social struggle, about, you know, dignified workplaces, and to move forward. I can tell you that my middle school, the mascot was the Running Rebels. And I can tell you that the mascot in my high school was an Indian. And what all that brings, right? This acceptance of a narrative of history that was a part of the curriculum, and it seeped down into our minds. It took me many years to undo what was done to me in particular in that K-12 system. The first time I began to learn more about Cesar Chavez in the UFW was in my first ethnic studies course in college. I still remember Dr. Benton, and I still remember sitting in the back of the classroom just listening. I wasn't a very good student at that point. Okay, let's just be clear. At that point, I was still learning to learn. But I, you know, still very much in deep. One thing I did discover early on was the library, and that was my sanctuary when I was those first few years at college. But I'll come back to that. Dr. Benton had a whole section of his syllabus devoted to the struggle of farm workers for labor rights. And I remember one particular student standing up and telling Dr. Benton that farm workers didn't deserve, you know, worker rights because this is, you know, if they were here, and obviously I'm paraphrasing from memory, if they were here, then, you know, these people needed to accept the conditions. And Dr. Benton replying, "You don't understand what you just said, and you don't understand what it is to work, and you don't understand your privilege." That was one of those moments in my life where I looked at a person in that type of position in sheer admiration. He stood up for me and my community without knowing that this was my community. From there, I ended up in the library in the Chicano section. I read books. I read plays. I still remember reading El Teatro Campesinos and a couple of their plays. I read about political behavior, Latino political behavior, and I was really immersed in learning. And like I said, learning is a process. And I think that by about my third or fourth year in college, I was able to really begin to synthesize and apply what I was learning in class about social structures and what I was learning in the library and what I was seeing in community as well. One of the highlights also of going to college was that I was a member of an organization. There's an organization here as well called MECHA, Movimiento Estudiantil Chicano de Aztlán, which comes from the Chicano movement of the 60s and 70s. and whose purpose was to introduce Chicanx history into higher ed and to democratize these places to be able to create space of learning, in particular for this population group, this history, this culture, right? Anyways, we had partnered with a couple of other organizations on campus and invited Cesar Chavez to campus. I think this was around 92, 93, and it was towards the tail end of his campaign, one of his last hunger strikes, to bring light to the cancer clusters in the Central Valley that were happening around where crop dusters mm-hmm. and other insecticides were being used in the crops. I got to shake Cesar Chavez's hand. And that, you know, that split-second interaction is still something that to this day I carry with me. And I understand, you know, I understand fully the academic and social debates around Cesar Chavez and the person he was and the person we interpret him to have been, right? Both the good, the bad, the ugly, and you know, and the myth, right? But at the end of the day, Cesar Chavez brought to the Central Valley of California and to the entirety of this country a sense of hope and possibility. You know, hope and possibility that there was an alternative and a better way to move forward as a community of farm workers within, by transforming the agricultural system by organizing it, meaning democratizing those workplaces. I ask students, you know, and I teach on the National Labor Relations Act. And we often talk about the two excluded workers, right? The two groups of workers that are excluded from the NLRA, you know, from this act that actually gives labor rights nationally to private sector workers. I'm surprised that folks don't know, right? And I tell them you can Google it and find it, right? It's agricultural workers and domestic workers. So these mm-hmm. two sets of workers are excluded very purposely from the NLRA. And when we take that over and talk about it some more, why were these two groups excluded? It's my estimation, and what the literature tells us is that they were the negotiated outcome for the Southern Democrats to go along with the NLRA and get it passed to support it. And who were these workers in the South? They were black folks.
Right. The ones that would have been like the maids and the
yes.
caretakers.
And the farm workers, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot to be said about why these folks were excluded from worker rights and from the right to be able to collectively act against their employer.
I noticed in your book, The Latino Question, that you have sort of what you would expect in an academic book with facts and history and footnotes, but you also have testimonials from people who are going through their lived experiences in the fields or in a cooperative or other places. And one quick question is about, I guess, wording. You know, your book is entitled The Latino Question. Sometimes now we say Latinx to cover male, female, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But we also hear Hispanic, Chicano, Mexican American, et cetera. Can you give us some sense of the wording and whether it matters, kind of, you know, because it's... Yeah, I hear many different things, and I saw in your book, too, lots of references and also a cautionary note not to lump everybody into one big block.
Yeah. It's a debate that's been going on in community and from out community for a long time. This whole idea that labels can capture that diversity and complexity of entire communities from across Latin America. I mean, it's a, you know, when we begin our book by quoting Ernesto Galarza. Ernesto Galarza is one of the foremost Mexican-American scholars of the 20th century.
And you wrote a book about him, I think.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
And I'm so embarrassed. I never heard of him until your book.
Well,
so.
And that's why we engaged in that project. It's because we hadn't heard of him. I hadn't heard mm-hmm. of him. He's he was a scholar activist, a union organizer, respected internationally, who was part of the development of some of the organizations that are still in existence today. Who when asked, you know, what are you? And again, I'm paraphrasing. Are you a Chicano? Are you a Hispanic? What are you? And his response was simple, right? He says, I don't have much use for labels that try to define me by ethnicities. If you want to know who I am, ask me what I do. If I'm a baker, I'm a baker. If I'm a mason, I'm a mason. If I'm a farm worker, I'm a farm worker. Those experiences are what shape my identity more so than any label that you could try to use to capture who I am. Part of this book was to really question this idea of labels as salient, right? And as standing alone, being able to capture what the current position of Latino populations are. And if you notice, I said populations in plural are. And our argument is that it's the struggles that these particular populations, those struggles that they have in production relations, that creates those identifying relationships within community. Not what you're called, but it's the experiences of struggle that create who you are. So to me, being Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine, are all capturing some sort of, all capturing pieces of that very complex working class group that is produced from struggle within production relations.
More on the Latino question and the future when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Men, women, and children cross international and state borders to tie, dig, plant, thin, pick, sort, weed, run, load, pack, can, and process food in almost every region of California, urban and rural. Wherever land needs to be prepared for planting or crops tended and harvested, you will find migrant farm worker families. No matter how hard they work, most will never achieve the American dream. That's a passage from the book The Latino Question, Politics, Labor, and Classes in the Next Left by my guest Armando Ibarra. That's talking about California, but I know you're focused a lot on Wisconsin. There's a chapter of the book about poverty in Milwaukee, and you're also studying agriculture, construction, and other industries here in Wisconsin. Can you tell us something about your work here in our state?
Yes, Emily, absolutely. You know, you when you read that piece of our work, it reminds me, it takes me back to the place where I come from, and know that those words are as true today for migrant farm worker families, or even farm worker families just in general in that region today, as they were when I was a child and a young person coming of age. In Wisconsin, I've engaged with immigrant working communities that are from Latin America, right? Latin American immigrants who I've been engaged doing some sort of community-based participatory research for the last 10 years or so. I have two projects right now that I want to talk about. The first one is a project that I'm doing in conjunction with an organization called Legal Action Wisconsin. And what I am leading, along with my co-PI, Alexa Kowig, a study on dairy workers. And dairy workers here in Wisconsin, basically, you know, their position, their needs, and to be able to tell a centered story of at least the folks that we spoke with, the qualitative study, right? And this has given us an opportunity to speak with dairy workers from across the state of Wisconsin. And not surprisingly, you know, the majority of these dairy workers have an unauthorized immigration status. And not surprisingly, many of them live on site, right? So they live at the farm where they work at the farm. And if we know anything about dairy and cows, cows need to be tended to and worked 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So you have these folks that live on site that do that job. So we're learning that dairy workers in Wisconsin are one of the most neglected workforce in our state, who have one of the biggest impact on not just the state's economy, but the state as a the state's social structures, right? Think about this. We are the dairy state. Our collective identity as Wisconsinites only continues this industry to not just survive, but thrive. It's the second largest industry in the state because of Latino, Latin American, immigrant, mostly unauthorized workers. 70 to 80% of the dairy industry workers are unauthorized immigrants from Latin America. So that whole industry would cease to exist if it wasn't for this workforce. So what we're doing is bringing to light a centered narrative of the stories of these workers. And we're doing that in conjunction with Legal Action Wisconsin. It's heart-wrenching to hear some of these stories in these interviews. And it's there is definitely some inconsistencies in the narratives about dairy and the exploitative nature of the industry.
Is it dangerous to shed a light on a situation where you've got so many unauthorized residents of Wisconsin? Does it, by you know, kind of shining a light? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, I think, always been a problem if you speak up when you know that doing so may lead to consequences.
This is part of the Wisconsin idea, right? The idea that we are going to take our inquiry and produce knowledge wherever it takes us. Maybe, I guess. It might be dangerous. I think it's more dangerous to not understand and not to act on trying to address some of the needs that the industry and the needs that these workers have. One of the surprising, you know, center narratives that's coming out of it is that many of these folks that work in this industry don't have bad things to say about the owners. But when it comes to the industry itself, you know, that's when we start seeing the reproducing of you know, this narrative of, you know, wages are low, hours are high, breaks are insufficient, no medical care, no leave, right? And we are socially isolated because the majority of us live on site.
And what's the solution? We only have a few minutes, but if you could somehow fix things so that it was better, so that people were treated with more humanity and dignity and fairness, what would you do?
We can take simple steps here in Wisconsin today and pass driver's license for all. That's a simple step that has a very quick, it's not a solution, it's not a fix, but it alleviates some of the problem for the majority of these workers. The ability to drive, the ability to take your kids to school, the ability to go to the market and pick up a gallon of milk. I mean, you take that away, you take that anxiety of that driving away. That's something that we can do here in the state. We can pass comprehensive immigration reform nationally, right, and allow these folks the ability to adjust their status from an unauthorized to an authorized immigrant.
Like a worker's visa or permit or just pathway or?
I think that a wide pathway to citizenship is what we need. The families, the people that are part of this industry are part of our communities. They're part of what are known as mixed-status families. They deserve the opportunity to reach a state of equality with the rest of us because of what they've given to us.
My guest has been Armando Ibarra, and we're talking about the Latino question. We're going to go out on the music that we opened with by Chuy Negrete. Can you just give me a little one-sentence gloss on him so that we can know what we're listening to?
Well, Chuy Negrete we brought him to campus a few years ago, and he was able to connect with students on campus. He was able to connect with our labor community at the Labor Temple, and he was able to connect with our immigrant community at Centro Hispano. And with his message of working class Mexican and Mexican Americans and their impacts in the Midwest. Just a brilliant mind with a talent for music.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Viva la causa en la historia. La raza llena de gloria. La victoria va a cumplir. La victoria va a cumplir.